Looking people, we're going to switch to the White House and our correspondents, Tom Brokaw and Tom Petty. Gentlemen.
John, on this final day for President Nixon and his administration, it was a day of expectancy around the White House this morning as the president scheduled a meeting with Vice President Ford at 11 o'clock. And then came word that the president had requested television time for tonight, that television time nearly upon us now. It seemed a confirmation that he had reached the decision that was breaking out all over Congress, that he had decided to resign. There was a certain sense of relief once that confirmation appeared this afternoon from White House aides, unofficially, and from other congressmen. And around the White House gates, there was a kind of theater of the absurd as the president's supporters and detractors gathered. But within the White House compound itself, a sense of ironic humor, sadness, and gravity as they recognize those people who have supported and worked for Richard Nixon, that this administration that they had dedicated their lives to was now coming to an end, as it was certain to this evening, all of them recognized. There was some talk about what they might do next and concern about what would happen to President Nixon. We only know that he is scheduled to leave for California tomorrow with a few of his closest aides, including Ron Ziegler, Jack Brennan, his military aide, Manolo Sanchez, his always ebullient valet, and then Steve Bull, the appointment secretary, will follow at a later time. Those people who have been very close to the president and know him well personally in the staff have been amazed, even in this final day, at his calmness. They talked about his serenity and about his strength, and I think that that was probably a comfort to them as well. He asked for one moment of privacy tonight, and that nearly got out of hand. He said he wanted to walk from the executive office building over to the White House without having lots of photographers and reporters around them, and he asked for that area to be sealed off. Well, the White House guards sealed off the entire White House complex, and reporters and visitors were not able to get in or out of the White House at that time. The White House later apologized, which has been unusual in these final few days as well. It's been kind of a frantic time. The president worked most of the day in his EOB office, which is filled with the mementos from his 28 years in public life. As he worked probably at a desk, as he has in the past, it is his practice to write out the speech in longhand, in his own hand, with many of his own thoughts. We're told that Ray Price, who has been with him a long time, contributed some phrases and some thoughts, and as did Pat Buchanan, one of the president's principal political strategists and speechwriters. Tom Pettit has been with me as well here tonight, and there is a quality that is hard to define. There are people here supporting the president, singing hymns, and then there are those people who are saying jail to the chief.
Tom, it's an ironic contrast to a scene we both remember 2 years ago when the president was reelected with that smashing victory, where there was all happiness and all claim to a mandate, ending all tonight, kind of amid this bizarre scene with these people holding up these signs, kind of breaking the dignity of the moment, because it truly is a solemn time. The removal voluntarily by his own action of a United States president. And that's what we're waiting to hear from his own lips as he explains why he's making that decision. I should think after your time at the White House that this would be kind of a traumatic moment too, to witness this exchange of power, but also to be rather happy about witnessing an exchange of power peacefully, orderly, without any problems. And I think that's been the delay this week, has it not?
I'm sure that it has been, working it out so that we would present to the rest of the world, and I'm confident that that was Secretary of State Kissinger's principal concern and primary mission in this week, was to demonstrate a unified administration and government to the rest of the world so that there would not be any undue challenges or international mischief, as General Haig reportedly said to some of the president's closest advisors, as at the end he was counseling resignation. It is hard to describe, I think, a reporter's own feelings as you witness this, as we have witnessed so much in the past year. The earth doesn't shake, and the government doesn't come to a grinding halt, and the country does go on, and that is very reassuring to us as well.
And that is very important, I think, because the man in the White House carries an enormous amount of power purely by dint of his office. It is a nuclear power, it is a veto power, it is a power that is virtually unmeasurable, and of course was finally measured in the Watergate case, I suppose, in a certain way, an abuse of power that led to what's going to happen here tonight. But I think it's important that the people keep in mind that the transition of power in the United States is occurring without the kind of incident that sometimes occurs in other republics or other countries around the world. And that's what we've been witnessing today, isn't it? The arrangements being made, carefully worked out, so that Mr. Ford can come into office knowing exactly where we stand in the world, so that he knows exactly where things are in the White House, what his powers actually are. And that's very important, it seems to me.
Truly is the constitutional process a handing over, if you will. John?
Well, I was just going to say that there were some fears that a desperate president trapped by impeachment might try some international adventure. There wasn't a shred of evidence that Mr. Nixon tried to do any of that, as far as I'm concerned or anybody else is concerned. But what also occurs to me, and I'd like you both to think about that, is that I don't think an American president could get away with that. And maybe this is another result of a new way we have of looking at the power in that office.
There are those people, John, who are so close to the president and have their personal loyalty to him as well as a man, Richard Nixon, or to any president who occupies that great office. But there has never been a demonstration that any person working closely with the president in any administration would be willing to take that kind of an extreme step. It truly has been a graceful transition, if you will, here today. And it has a uniquely American character about it. As all of these people gather outside the White House gates, supporters and tractors, as I said, civil to one another, signs side by side saying support the president and impeach him. And there is something uniquely American and reassuring about that as well. However much this does not measure all of America outside of 1600 Pennsylvania tonight.
John, it seems that there's very little gloating going on around here, either among the people on Pennsylvania Avenue or the people in Congress. The Democrats, who perhaps have had the most gain, in a sense, from the Watergate scandal, there's very little sense of gloating going on.
Well, I don't think anybody should be gloating. My own view is that the most rabid anti-Nixon people in the country shouldn't be gloating. This kind of transfer of power has never taken place in the United States before, and it is, in fact, and indeed, a national tragedy that we have come to this with a man who occupies the highest office in the land, a very unique office under the American system, quite unlike presidents in many other countries. So that it is a tragic moment in our history, and I don't think anybody, George McGovern, who was trounced by Nixon 21 months ago in that election, said today that he was sorry that things had come this way. And I don't think there's anybody, be he a partisan Democrat or a right-wing Republican or anybody in between, who would not feel, as I feel, and I think we all feel, sort of kicked to the stomach by this. It's a national tragedy of just terrible proportions. And yet, as I look around at the United States today, going to work and looking out the window, the country is not racked with stripes. There aren't people fighting other people. There are no mobs in the streets. There are no riots in the country. And I think it's been demonstrated with great vividness that this wrenching ordeal, which it is not tearing the country apart by any means. The American people, I think, in this hour, if I may be allowed to say this, are living up to their responsibilities and learning to live with tragedy. And I think that my colleagues there on the White House lawn would agree with me. I think that it's a terrible moment for the country, a terrible moment for Mr. Nixon, but overall, we have not reacted badly to the tragic events which are unfolding, and the power is going to be transferred in an orderly and constitutional way from one man who is leaving now, going into political exile in California, to another man who 8 months ago had as his highest objective being Speaker of the House of Representatives. And tonight, or tomorrow, Gerald Ford will become the 38th President of the United States. But now it's time for the 37th President to talk, Richard Nixon. And he is going to speak to us now from the Oval Office in the White House in Washington, President Richard M. Nixon.
Good evening. This is the 37th time I have spoken to you from this office. where so many decisions have been made that shaped the history of this nation. Each time I have done so to discuss with you some matter that I believe affected the national interest. In all the decisions I have made in my public life, I have always tried to do what was best for the nation. Throughout the long and difficult period of Watergate, I have felt it was my duty to persevere, to make every possible effort to complete the term of office to which you elected me. In the past few days, however, it has become evident to me that I no longer have a strong enough political base in the Congress to justify continuing that effort. As long as there was such a base, I felt strongly that it was necessary to see the constitutional process through to its conclusion, that to do otherwise would be unfaithful to the spirit of that deliberately difficult process, and a dangerously destabilizing precedent for the future. But with the disappearance of that base, I now believe that the constitutional purpose has been served, and there is no longer a need for the process to be prolonged. I would have preferred to carry through to the finish, whatever the personal agony it would have involved. And my family unanimously urged me to do so. But the interests of the nation must always come before any personal considerations. From the discussions I have had with congressional and other leaders, I have concluded that because of the Watergate matter, I might not have the support of the Congress that I would consider necessary to back the very difficult decisions and carry out the duties of this office in the way the interests of the nation will require. I have never been a quitter. To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body. But as president, I must put the interests of America first. America needs a full-time president and a full-time Congress, particularly at this time with problems we face at home and abroad. To continue to fight through the months ahead for my personal vindication would almost totally absorb the time and attention of both the President and the Congress in a period when our entire focus should be on the great issues of peace abroad and prosperity without inflation at home. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow. Vice President Ford will be sworn in as president at that hour in this office. As I recall the high hopes for America with which we began this second term, I feel a great sadness that I will not be here in this office working on your behalf to achieve those hopes in the next 2.5 years. But in turning over direction of the government to Vice President Ford, I know, as I told the nation when I nominated him for that office 10 months ago, that the leadership of America will be in good hands. In passing this office to the Vice President, I also do so with a profound sense of the weight of responsibility that will fall on his shoulders tomorrow, and therefore of the understanding, the patience, the cooperation he will need from all Americans. As he assumes that responsibility, he will deserve the help and the support of all of us. As we look to the future, the first essential is to begin healing the wounds of this nation, to put the bitterness and divisions of the recent past behind us, and to rediscover those shared ideals that lie at the heart of our strength and unity as a great and as a free people. By taking this action, I hope that I will have hastened the start of that process of healing which is so desperately needed in America. I regret deeply any injuries that may have been done in the course of the events that led to this decision. I would say only that if some of my judgments were wrong, and some were wrong, they were made in what I believed at the time to be the best interest of the nation. To those who have stood with me during these past difficult months, to my family, my friends, to many others who joined in supporting my cause because they believed it was right, I will be eternally grateful for your support. And to those who have not felt able to give me your support, let me say, I leave with no bitterness toward those who have opposed me. Because all of us in the final analysis have been concerned with the good of the country, however our judgments might differ. So let us all now join together in affirming that common commitment and in helping our new president succeed for the benefit of all Americans. I shall leave this office with regret at not completing my term, but with gratitude for the privilege of serving as your president for the past 5.5 years. These years have been a momentous time in the history of our nation and the world. They have been a time of achievement in which we can all be proud. Achievements that represent the shared efforts of the administration, the Congress, and the people. But the challenges ahead are equally great, and they too will require the support and the efforts of the Congress and the people working in cooperation with the new administration. We have ended America's longest war, but in the work of securing a lasting peace in the world, the goals ahead are even more far-reaching and more difficult. We must complete a structure of peace so that it will be said of this generation, our generation of Americans, by the people of all nations, not only that we ended one war, but that we prevented future wars. We have unlocked the doors that for a quarter of a century stood between the United States and the People's Republic of China. We must now ensure that the one quarter of the world's people who live in the People's Republic of China will be and remain not our enemies, but our friends. In the Middle East, 100 million people in the Arab countries, many of whom have considered us their enemy for nearly 20 years, now look on us as their friends. We must continue to build on that friendship so that peace can settle at last over the Middle East and so that the cradle of civilization will not become its grave. Together with the Soviet Union, we have made the crucial breakthroughs that have begun the process of limiting nuclear arms. But we must set as our goal not just limiting, but reducing and finally destroying these terrible weapons so that they cannot destroy civilization and so that the threat of nuclear war will no longer hang over the world and the people. We have opened a new relation with the Soviet Union. We must continue to develop and expand that new relationship, so that the two strongest nations of the world will live together in cooperation rather than confrontation. Around the world, in Asia, in Africa, in Latin America, in the Middle East, there are millions of people who live in terrible poverty, even starvation. We must keep as our goal turning away from production for war and expanding production for peace, so that people everywhere on this earth can at last look forward in their children's time, if not in our own time, to having the necessities for a decent life. Here in America, we are fortunate that most of our people have not only the blessings of liberty, but also the means to live full and good, and by the world's standards, even abundant lives. We must press on, however, toward a goal not only of more and better jobs, but of full opportunity for every American. And of what we are striving so hard right now to achieve, prosperity without inflation. For more than a quarter of a century in public life, I have shared in the turbulent history of this era. I have fought for what I believed in. I have tried, to the best of my ability, to discharge those duties and meet those responsibilities that were entrusted to me. Sometimes I have succeeded, and sometimes I have failed. But always, I have taken heart from what Theodore Roosevelt once said about the man in the arena whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs and comes short again and again because there is not effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deed, who knows the great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumphs of high achievements, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly. I pledge to you tonight that as long as I have a breath of life in my body, I shall continue in that spirit. I shall continue to work for the great causes to which I have been dedicated throughout my years as a congressman, a senator, vice president, and president. The cause of peace, not just for America, but among all nations. Prosperity, justice, and opportunity for all of our people. There is one cause, above all, to which I have been devoted and to which I shall always be devoted for as long as I live. When I first took the oath of office as president 5.5 years ago, I made this sacred commitment to consecrate my office, my energies, and all the wisdom I can summon to the cause of peace among nations. I've done my very best in all the days since to be true to that pledge. As a result of these efforts, I am confident that the world is a safer place today, not only for the people of America, but for the people of all nations, and that all of our children have a better chance than before of living in peace rather than dying in war. This, more than anything, is what I hoped to achieve when I sought the presidency. This, more than anything, is what I hope will be my legacy. To you, to our country, as I leave the presidency. To have served in this office is to have felt a very personal sense of kinship with each and every American. In leaving it, I do so with this prayer. May God's grace be with you in all the days ahead.
Well, one hardly knows what to say. That was a shot of the White House you saw with a squad car or a fire engine on its way to an ordinary mundane chore in our ordinary and mundane lives while history was being made in the Oval Office. At 9:04 this evening, Richard M. Nixon became the first president ever to resign his office. The talk, as you saw, was restrained and statesmanlike. Mr. Nixon properly accounting his achievements in foreign affairs, listing his desires for this country, pledging that he will go on working for it. The Watergate matter, as the president referred to it, was mentioned only once. The theme of the speech in terms of Watergate seemed to be that the president had lost his political base because of Watergate in the Congress, and therefore found it impossible to continue the policies and the programs of his administration. He did not mention impeachment. He did not mention the fact that the leaders of both the House and the Senate had informed him that he would be impeached and in a Senate trial might be removed from office. He said that his family wanted him to stay unanimously. He said that he wanted to stay on in his term until the end so he could carry on in his work. He said he deeply regretted any injuries that had been caused to people during his presidency. He said that there may be some people, some of my judgments were wrong, and he said some were wrong. He made those misjudgments in what he thought was the best interest of the country. But what you saw this evening, a moment ago, we are not likely to see again in our lives. We've never seen it before in 198 years of the history of this republic. A president has resigned his office. Tomorrow, we'll have a new president. And the world goes on. I'd like to see what our reporters Tom Brokaw and Tom Pettit have to say about this. They're outside the White House.
Very quickly, John, I should explain that the crowd behind us, demonstrators principally opposed to the president, rushed across to the fence there in front of the White House yelling jail to the chief, so you may hear some extraneous sounds, or at least demonstrators, in the course of our conversation. Clearly, the president expects that his legacy will be his foreign policy. It is the area that he cared the most about, spent the most time on, and it is the area, I think, that he is counting on for his historical redemption eventually. He dwelled at length about détente with Russia, opening China, and with ending the war in Vietnam. It is the area that President Nixon liked to talk about the most, informally or officially, with Secretary of State Kissinger or with world leaders. He dearly loved to travel, seeking world peace, as he just returned this past summer for political and also for diplomatic reasons from the Middle East and from the Soviet Union. And as a White House correspondent who covers him very closely, I never saw him happier or more confident or more at ease than he was, strangely enough, on the streets of Moscow, or as you saw him, I'm sure, in the streets of Cairo. He probably, tonight, defined his character with more grace than he did 12 years ago when he said, "I'm not a quitter. I find that abhorrent." This was a very painful, agonizing decision for him, clearly. And for those opponents or critics of the president, or for even those Republicans who have become disenchanted with him, who might have expected some kind of acknowledgement of guilt tonight, he certainly did not offer that. As you indicated, he talked only about losing his political base and what that meant to the national interest for a president of the United States. He said that he'd made some misjudgments, some wrong judgments, He meant not to injure anyone, but he talked not at all about abusing the office of the presidency, nor did he indicate in any way that he expected to lose the impeachment case or to be convicted in the Senate. He concentrated instead on the loss of the political base and what that meant to all of the people for a president and the great power of that office depending on congressional support. It was 12 years ago in California that Richard Nixon made another farewell speech after losing the race for governor to Pat Brown. My colleague, Tom Pettit of NBC News, was there, and that speech was markedly different than this one tonight, was it not, Tom?
Oh, yes, it was, Tom. I think this was without a doubt the best of the Nixon crisis speeches. It was better than Checkers.